Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How should law enforcement officers balance sensitivity and authority in order to protect and serve their communities, especially in places where racial tension divides police from their constituents? Last summer, the shooting of Michael Brown, who was black, by a Ferguson, Missouri police officer who is white, reminded people in many parts of the country that racial diversity is still a potential flashpoint. As Dallas Police Chief David Brown has worked to build stronger relationships between his department and the numerous ethnic and socioeconomic groups it serves, he is launching a new website this month to provide the facts about every officer-involved shooting in the city since 2003. He joins us now to talk about that effort and others. Chief Brown, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So how would you say North Texas, and Dallas in particular, stacks up to other metropolitan regions in terms of racial tension and the ways that it affects law enforcement?
We have our challenges, to be quite honest. And we don't have the best of history going back 20, 30 years, but we've worked really hard in North Texas, particularly in Dallas, to make sure that we are engaged with the community. And we've had as a priority during my tenure as chief to have a sense of urgency around community engagement and community policing. And the Ferguson, Missouri example is just, you know, what can go wrong when you're not making the right connections with the right folks in the community.
When you say what can go wrong, are you referring to the shooting itself, to the response to the shooting? What's your sense of it now that more facts have come out and people are getting a better handle on exactly what happened?
The response to the shootings, mm-hmm. Almost regardless of the facts, you have certain responses in certain communities, communities of color, particularly black communities who have a horrible experience going back decades with police-community relationships. And many times the perspective is shaped by the history of the relationship, not necessarily the particular incident that just happened. And so any narratives that come out that are similar to the history then almost becomes something that has a life of its own, regardless of the facts. And so you're dealing with not just what just happened, but the history. So that makes having a relationship much more important. And the aftermath of any controversy or crisis situation is the wrong time to try to establish a relationship. It's almost too late to establish a relationship, and now you're uphill trying to just mitigate the outpouring of emotion.
A lot of parents in recent years, black parents, have started to be open and talk about the talk that they have, especially with their sons, when it comes to dealing with a police officer. First of all, can you explain what the talk is as you understand it?
Well, that's an important conversation to have, and I wouldn't just put black parents in that conversation. I think every parent ought to have a conversation about dealing with the police. Many young people challenge authority, and when they're dealing with the police, they may not necessarily understand it's important to follow instructions. The talk that my mother had with me, and I'm hopeful that many parents have, is that, you know, be careful about how you act, your behavior, you know, follow instructions, you know. And what's not really understood in many instances is that the police are there, first of all, to protect them, and they're there to protect the immediate environment. But sudden movements, certain types of behavior really escalate the interaction with police. And so that conversation that parents are having and what I've understood to be the conversation that parents, black parents, have with their young black boys is, you know, keep your hands on the steering wheel. Don't make any sudden movements. Don't fight the police, which is something that in almost every neighborhood meeting I go to is I express fighting with the police. And you may have some legitimate complaints about what the police have done, but fighting with the police is the absolute wrong thing to do to resolve your complaint toward the police, because in every fight, the police have to win. Because if they lose their fight with suspects or with people who feel aggrieved, they could lose their gun. If they lose their gun, the officer will lose his life. And that's the perspective of the police officer that young men need to understand, that fighting with us to resolve grievances or complaints is the absolute wrong thing to do, because the officers in every case is going to be fighting for their lives.
How often do you hear from people who say, well, fighting back is my only shot because no one's going to listen down the line when I'm in court or when I'm trying to explain my grievances otherwise? People who feel as if they can't use the sort of legitimate standard protocols for expressing their concerns and grievances.
I do understand that complaint, but it's a bigger issue. And it's not just stuck in time in this moment in time. It's I think it's coming out of this distrust in government overall from Washington, D.C. And you just see it at the local level, particularly with police officer interactions, especially in crisis moments where there's a police involved shooting or some police officer uses force. And the facts that officers will say something happened this way, people don't generally want to believe it. And they want to believe the narrative of that based on history, we've had this happen in our neighborhood and it was wrong and it was bad and the police have to admit it. Some of the criticism we've earned because of some of those interactions. I mean, it's you just follow Rodney King incident in L.A., and it paints the whole law enforcement profession with a broad brush. A 50-man police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, is defining law enforcement. And we're a 3,500, Dallas is a 3,500 officer department, but we are continuing to be defined by any officer in the country in the way they conduct themselves and the way they treat people. It's just so important to, first of all, be transparent about what happened. That's why we're at the advent of using body cameras, to have that evidence, because people don't generally want to believe what the officer says.
What would a body camera show definitively that interviews with the suspect and the officer sometimes doesn't?
I think it adds context. The officers at the end of a crisis are being interviewed and trying as best they can to describe what happened in a life or death situation. And there are things where the context is not there based on just an interview, a Q&A. An officer may, several days later, have more information to give. What the video will show is the perspective from the officer. The video's on the officer's uniform, and it shows almost answering the questions, why this escalated to using force. And many times, very small movements by an individual can cause the officer to react in a more escalated way, where a Q&A answer session with a police department investigator investigating the shooting may not get that context. And people were visual. People are visual. They want to see what you say happened. They don't necessarily just want to. Just a video. They want to match video with what you said happened. And so it just makes it much more, in my opinion, transparent. And then with transparency comes accountability. Once you have that evidence on video, then what happens next?
I was going to ask you about that, because in the past, I know some of the training, it certainly was never the focus, but some of the training regarding the use of deadly force against a suspect had to do with making sure that when you were when the officer was asked about this, they could sort of justify what they had done. I wonder if you think that the presence of those cameras, knowing that that will be evidence as well, will cause some officers to think more carefully about discharging a weapon against a suspect.
It's absolutely going to be a two-way street with this type of evidence, video evidence. Is that training ought to be geared around what this evidence shows as far as officers' behavior. I'll put it this way. You know, the most belligerent drunk is going to act professional on video. And your problem cops will treat people better because they know they're on video. And so I think the video will level the playing field on both sides, that you get citizens acting better and maybe less belligerent, less violent toward cops, hopefully. But you also will get a benefit from cops being more professional because they know that they're on video. And when complaints come, we see the video, it will support the citizen who complained on the officer not acting appropriately.
Every organization has its stars and then the people that either need additional training or simply aren't going to work out within the organization. You can't simply eliminate everyone who's on the force when they make a mistake, and I don't know that you'd want to, but can you talk a little bit about how you and your colleagues within the department attempt to identify officers who might in fact be a danger to the community, recognizing that that is probably a very small minority of officers on the street, but they exist within the force?
Yes. Our hiring practices, we try to screen folks that don't need to be in this profession out during the hiring process. But, you know, I just got to be honest with you. Some people make it through the hiring process that probably shouldn't be cops, and we don't recognize that until that critical incident happens and they don't perform like we like and they paint everybody with a broad brush on the department when 99% of us are doing what the citizens expect us to do. And what we try to do is, you know, as much as we can flag these folks in our organization and as much as we can with all the hiring rules, termination rules, civil service rules, due process, try to get these folks out of our organizations. But when we can't, we try as much as we can through training to change behavior and get these folks conforming to the rules. What's not missed here is we hire people. We're in a people business, and people are flawed. And so we hire from the pool of humanity, and we hire people who are flawed. And particularly during a crisis, you really never really know how you're going to react when somebody's shooting at you or someone's trying to kill you. You hope that you'd only use the force necessary to stop the person from harming you, and then you would use no more greater force than is needed. But emotions are in play, and some people can't control their emotions as much. As much as you want to train that emotional reaction out of a cop, you have that there because we're hiring from humanity. We're hiring people from, and so people have some flaws that training will not overcome, and we, of course, have to pay for some of those flaws that some officers react to. But I want to emphasize here, that's a small, small portion of the law enforcement profession, but one is one too many.
How would you characterize the unity and cohesiveness across different racial and ethnic groups from within the department itself?
We want to be representative of the communities we police. And Dallas has done a decent job at being representative. But again, race is the most difficult conversation to have. And then you add in our profession, makes it even more difficult. I believe the police profession is better at it than most other types of agencies. Everyone shies away from racial, but we have to deal with it because, you know, we still make house calls.
Right.
And so when you call us, we're going to come to your home and we're going to be in your home trying to make decisions that are constitutional first, that are, you know, that are ethical and moral next. And so we want to make sure that we don't violate anyone's constitutional right. And we want to make sure that we're doing the most ethical, moral thing when we make that decision. And that's in a split second many times, that all of that is in consideration in a split second. And the second guessing, the Monday morning quarterback, comes from our office. It comes from the politicians in that city, and it comes from media, and then it comes from folks in the community who have a history with the police that's not so good. And so our officers are in a tight spot, but we absolutely need the police to act professionally and take all these things into consideration and do the right things when we're dealing with our citizens, keeping in mind that what they do affects the profession.
We're speaking this hour with Dallas Police Chief David Brown about public safety and justice in a diverse community. By the way, the Facing Race National Conference takes place tomorrow through Saturday in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dallas Police Chief David Brown about public safety and justice in a diverse community. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Chief Brown, I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of community policing. First of all, how do we get communities to accept that the police officers that are there are a positive force within the community as opposed to a force that comes in from the outside somewhere to sort of hassle them as they're trying to go on about their business?
It is the challenge for the police departments in the 21st century. We've always had community policing as a priority, but I don't think so much as a sense of urgency toward engaging the community and affecting community policing. So we really do have to get communities engaged in non-crisis situations. Unfortunately, our officers are responding to 911 calls, and people are calling 911 because there's a crisis. And if that's the only interaction, you're going to be failing as an organization, as a police organization, in affecting community policing appropriately. You have to try to find as many ways as possible to engage communities when there's no crisis, which means preventative and proactive. And that is, in my opinion, the best outcomes you could possibly have at reducing crime as well, is when you're engaging communities when there's no crisis. Otherwise, you're just being reactive and you're just following crime that's happening and not really having an effect on significantly reducing crime. And I think that excuses to engage the community when there's no crisis ought to be targeted toward young people in particular to have the greatest effect now and in the future. And I think the most challenging neighborhoods ought to be the highest priority of law enforcement agencies to engage.
Ideally, every police officer working for a significant amount of time in a particular neighborhood would be from that place or would live there. Obviously, this is not, you know, in certain parts of Dallas that you serve, officers couldn't possibly afford to live there.
Right.
In other parts of Dallas, they may decide the school situation isn't right or it just isn't the right neighborhood for their family. So how do you help officers to feel truly as much a part of the communities they are working in as the individuals who actually have their homes and their beds there?
And we don't have officers living in our city. Most of our officers don't live in the city, and that's a struggle with connecting with the community because you're not from the city. First of all, our hiring practices need to continue to evolve toward hiring people from the city, and that's one aspect. They still may move to the suburbs, but at least they're from the city. I'm born and raised in the city. I'm a third-generation Dallasite. I think that benefits me in understanding particularly challenging neighborhoods. So if you don't have the officers living there, the next best thing is to have officers in these communities doing a lot of non-traditional policing activities. I mentioned youth programs like Police Athletic League, but also we have programs called Blue in the School. We have Explorer programs. They're like Boy Scouts for kids that want to be cops when they grow up. We have a Coffee with Cops program where we go and have a partnership with McDonald's Corporation where we serve coffee in the morning as people are going to work early in the morning. So we're just trying to find any and every excuse to engage folks, to get in a conversation with them, have a dialogue, and then quickly talking about public safety in that exchange of information and explaining the services that are available, not just law enforcement services, but other services, including, you know, sometimes, you know, health services that are available. Much of the core problems with crime is non-police related, like dealing with addiction, dealing with mental health. And so those type of connections and those type of conversations are great excuses to engage folks when there's not a crisis.
Growing up here, how did you feel about the police in your neighborhood?
Apprehension. I had the same concerns that many people have today, is that, you know, not necessarily that I was afraid of the police, but, you know, the police are there for people that get in trouble and not for people to just say hi to in passing. And
like your sense was better to just not make eye contact in case,
right,
they mess with you.
Keep moving. I'm not doing anything wrong. Keep moving. Don't, you know, it wasn't a relationship that I wanted to foster.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I went off to college from my Oak Cliff neighborhood that I really started thinking about the profession. because it was at the advent of crack cocaine being sold in Dallas in the early 80s when I went off to college at UT Austin and came back in the summers to see my old neighborhood just basically falling apart under the crack cocaine epidemic in Dallas. And it was then during those summers that I decided to be part of the solution by becoming a cop. And it has been, it continues to be my motivation for being a cop after 31 years now, is that, first of all, have an effect on obviously public safety for the city, but I'm always particularly concerned with my old neighborhood as well.
A lot of people, of course, have proposed that if we were to relax or modify existing drug laws, we could clear up a lot of the disparate proportions of people of color, black and brown, being arrested, prosecuted, jailed. What do you think about that? I mean, recognizing that you have to enforce the drug laws as they exist now, are they too draconian?
Well, I would just talk about this issue, not just in that compartment of the issue. It's just incarceration rates have not resulted in safer neighborhoods. We've had, in our country, the highest incarceration rates in the 80s and 90s. And we had the highest crime rates in the 80s and 90s. And now, if you look at from a research perspective, we have lower incarceration rates in our cities across the country these last 10, 15 years, and the lowest crime rates. Actually, across the board in almost every major city, the lowest crime rates in decades with lower incarceration rates. I think we're doing a better job with diversion courts. I think we're doing a better job with how we're probating people, conditions of probation, including, you know, drug counseling. And so not just in, you know, the low-level drug effects on people of color, that is disproportionate, but just a broader conversation about incarceration and the effects on folks. I think it's the biggest failure of society is when you arrest that person. It's the biggest failure of society because we're going to chase. That person's not going to be hireable. You're not going to hire that person. That person is going to go into a criminal justice system that is not going to change the behavior. And so they're going to be probated and paroled back to the same neighborhood. And cops are going to be chasing them for the next 30, 35 years as they commit crime, more than likely. The recidivism rates are high, 70-80% recidivism. So the biggest challenge for society is to figure out a way to change folks' behavior, to try to make them whole again when they make these mistakes. And so reentry programs, how these folks get hired, what expungement means to people when they make a mistake, particularly for felons who can't vote, they can't participate in society. And you know, of course, you know, police officers become the social service of last resort. Mm-hmm. And so it's on our plate to solve all these broad problems that touch public health. They touch mental health. They touch so many other disciplines. But it's the police officer that has to mitigate all these challenging societal norms and then just throw in poverty in our education systems in the big cities. And, you know, it becomes overwhelming for the cop. But at the same time, we sometimes are the only functional adult that some young people in these areas see. And so we have to be engaged.
We want our children to be safe. We want our schools to be drug-free. On the other hand, many people are really concerned about, you know, people are calling it the school-to-prison pipeline, this idea that, you know, every 12-year-old has to be frisked and, you know, sent through a metal detector before, you know, history class every day is disturbing to people. Is there a way to provide safety on school campuses without doing what, in some people's opinion, is getting children ready for a life that will include something like incarceration?
Yes. Whatever you do with pre-K, just basic education, getting kids ready to read, because if they come to school not ready to read at first grade, the catch-up is almost impossible. And then once you get past third grade and you're not on pace, you land in the laps of law enforcement.
It's devastating to think that it happens that early.
Yes, and it is the challenge of our society. And, of course, you know, law enforcement has to figure this out because we respond to the homes on 911 calls of folks that have dysfunctional nuclear family units. But at the same time, I think the conversation from police on this, I think it could be a great starting point with engaging collaboration with all these other agencies who may be afraid to come to that neighborhood because of the public safety challenges. They don't feel safe there. And so maybe the police does provide that lead role in all these other multidisciplines to get school safety first and then to engage those organizations that help at a pre-K level or at a different kind of educational, dealing with job training, dealing with poverty, dealing with just kind of multiple different types of disciplines that don't have anything to do with policing. But the failure of those has everything to do with policing.
Right. It does and it doesn't, right? Because it's poverty is at the heart of all this.
Yeah, and poverty is not high crime. Poverty is high victimization,
right. The
result being high crime.
Mm-hmm.
So in poor communities, criminals prey on people who are poor, and that's a high victimization rate, which means high crime rates. And so anywhere you have population density and high poverty, you have out-of-control crime, and only the police there is the social service of last resort.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Warren in Waco. Hi, Warren.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I mentioned Waco because I live in a small town at the suburb of Waco. It's Woodway, Texas, and we're fortunate to have the police chief, Yost Zachary. He's the president of the International Police Chiefs Association. Anyway, a couple of things I wanted to mention was that with being a small city, unlike Dallas, the police are very proactive, and it's pretty amazing to see. And they have time to do that, which is nice. But there's a couple of things. One is that I'm sure Dallas has that the Citizens Police Academy.
Yes.
And I've gone through that twice. And I plan to go through it next year. That'll be I did it 20 years ago next year. Be a 20th anniversary. I did it. But anyway, it's very informative. I encourage the listeners to check that out.
Well, what happens at those Citizens Police Academies? Thanks so much for your call, Warren.
Well, we really acclimate citizens to the police profession. We visit the 911 center. People can get a chance to see how the call gets dispatched. And we have a ride-along opportunity for citizens to ride along with an officer on a shift. We introduce them to the investigative agencies, the bureaus. We do a lot of how-to report types of training where we expose people to how to report fraud and credit card theft, all the things that people need to know, domestic violence. We do a lot of preventative education where, you know, how to secure your home properly, how to do what's important about lighting and keeping the shrubs cut back, kind of some common sense things. And so it's a great opportunity to engage folks in our profession, to get more understanding, get more dialogue. And we leave, you know, contact information on how to call us directly when you have concerns that may not be right to the level of 911 call. So those are really, really important. But it really speaks to a much broader challenge that we have. So the person that would come to a Citizens Police Academy or to a traditional Crime Watch meeting or to all the other traditional ways that we interact with the community through organizations like NAACP or LULAC or kind of traditional ways, that won't reach the young people we need to reach because they're not going to do those types of things. And so the challenge is, how do we reach young people, the 20-somethings, the teenagers? And unfortunately, I'm 54 now, and so it's not automatic to me how to reach young people. I've got to talk to my young cops on how to reach young people. So we're hiring 21-year-old cops, and I need to, and other, you know, police chiefs need to engage the young cops on how to reach young people. And that is going to be through social media, unfortunately, not traditional media, not through traditional ways that we interact, like Citizens Police Academy or having a meeting with the NAACP, because young people, they do their own thing, and they communicate all the time, and they don't do it through traditional ways.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, we've talked about racial diversity in the city and in the department. Talk about how you manage the diversity when you have officers who might be in their 50s and officers who are in their early 20s. There's a big cultural difference, even if one is of the same race and background.
Right. So we all come into this profession to help people, to protect and serve. But there are probably three different generations in our organization. You still got this baby boomer generation in our organization that's about to retire. And then you have the Gen X and Y, and then you have the millennials, all in the same sometimes in the same detail room about to clear a shift, and they all have different motivations on why they're here and different loyalties and different reasoning behind why they do what they do. And we've got to communicate with them all differently. You know, the same message won't reach all of the employees the same way. And so we do a lot in trying to communicate with folks in the organization to make sure we message the priority of community policing. But for the majority now, which is, you know, we have quite a bit of transition now with the baby boomers about to retire. We've got mostly young people in our organization. And I would say that's probably how it is with a lot of law enforcement agencies, particularly the large ones, is that, you know, the young people come here for an adventure. They come here to chase crooks. They want to get in car chases and foot chases and catch the bad guys. And they don't necessarily see as a priority engaging the community.
So you got to rein that in, that desire for adventure.
Not too much.
Right.
But yes, we
mm-hmm.
had to rein it in because we do want them catching bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to do it in a way that discourages the core principles of the job is making neighborhoods safe. But you also don't want them to not understand the importance of engaging the community and making sure they are proactive and also have conversations about being preventative, because the best way to reduce crime is to prevent it from happening in the first place. That's the best way. You know, catching criminals means the crime's already happened. So you need to do both, and you need to make sure that they have the idea or the philosophy of your job is to do both and the preventative, the proactive, and traditional.
We're speaking this hour with Dallas Police Chief David Brown about public safety and justice in a diverse community. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dallas Police Chief David Brown about public safety and justice in a diverse community. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. And Chief Brown, you've got a Twitter feed as well?
Sure, I do. It's at DPD Chief, and the department's Twitter feed is at Dallas PD.
You hear a lot of interesting things? Do you learn a lot of interesting things following Twitter?
I do, and we try to make it fun. I mean, we want to be engaging because we want people to use all methods of communication with the department, because at the end of the day, we're going to have a crisis, and we want to be able to communicate with you. One of the things that came out of the Boston bombings is the Boston PD's use of Twitter to give people information about what happened and to correct information, because rumors were all over the place, and so any method, you know, if I'll send smoke signals if that's what it takes to communicate with the community. I mean, I'd use a tin can and a string. I mean, it's just you can't not try as public servants to be as transparent as possible, and you do that through communication.
Small diversion here. Now that people are giving up their landlines, when they had them, dispatch had an automatic, they got information about where somebody was calling from. Has this turned out to be a problem at all in people who are in true crisis situations that may not be in a position to explain where they are?
Right. If you think about that whole environment, the original 911 center was built in the landline generation.
Right.
And so most centers are in the basements of buildings because, you know, you wanted to protect that center because that was a network for communicating to officers and to citizens. And so you think about the wireless generation now, 70% of our 911 calls are from a cell phone. not from a landline. 70% are from a cell phone. And just think about the connection in a basement where most 911 centers are, and the inability to find the location when a person can't communicate. Because a landline, you automatically knew the location because the landline was connected to the network. And so 911 centers are needing to change. And that change is going to be at quite a bit of cost to taxpayers. It's very expensive to create the type of 911. Smart texting 911 is one idea that's been at the forefront of 911 centers, along with trying to figure out how to locate citizens that's calling from a cell phone, given that, you know, how the cell towers ping the phone.
Right.
And so you know that general area where people are when they're calling from a cell phone, but you don't know the longitude, latitude of that particular cell phone necessarily without more infrastructure being built around the cell tower. And so, you know, multiple providers all having different ways they ping off a tower. So it's quite a challenge for law enforcement to keep up with the advances of technology.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Holsey in Oak Cliff. Hi, Holsey.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, Chief. I appreciate the management of the department by you and have attended some community meetings with you. My concern is this. Do you have the tools to measure the psychological background of officers to assess their potential for acting in a, let's say, racist way when they are under threat?
Yeah, yes, that's a great question. We do require psychological testing. I think you're speaking more toward, you know, maybe are there some testing that tests bias under stress, and we've discussed that, but we haven't found a way to test bias under stress. We test officers' reactions under stress, mostly tactically, if they're going to be able to perform and function, and we do test their psychological stability, and so we are challenged with hiring from a diverse pool of people and everyone having some type of bias, which is not necessarily a negative, but through training and through our rules, our policies, we believe that we're going to be able to continue to provide professional police service. But again, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, you know, the flaw of humanity is the biggest challenge. You know, we're hiring people and people are flawed, all of us. And as much as we can, when we do make mistakes, we just admit them. We hold people accountable and we're transparent about it. And we try as much as we can to maintain the public's trust and confidence through that transparency and accountability.
We have an email here from Paul who asks, the so-called 72-hour rule that you established that allows officers involved in a shooting to share notes with other officers and viewed all available audio and video prior to making statements. Paul says, this seems antithetical to transparency. Actually, it seems like a formula for cover-up. Can you explain the rule and how it contributes to transparency?
And I really appreciate that question because it's a great opportunity for me to explain why that's important. So during a police-involved shooting where that 72-hour rule is put in place, there's two types of investigations that are occurring. One is a criminal investigation. Anytime someone is shot and killed in Dallas County, it goes for the grand jury, and that officer is actually considered a suspect until that grand jury clears them. But there's also an administrative investigation, which is the employment law application of that officer following our policy. So two investigations, following the law and following the police department's policy that's administrative. Under the criminal investigation, where we're trying to determine if the officer broke the law, the officer has the same constitutional rights that any citizens have, which is the right to remain silent. But because they are a public servant, a police officer employed by us, we can require them to give us a statement. And because we can, as an employer, we're under constitutional rules. There's case law, a case called Garrity. A Garrity case means if the officer is employed by us and we, through our employment, require him to give us a statement, that cannot be used against him in a criminal law, because you can't have a rule, administrative rule, to overrule the constitutional right, the Miranda rights. So the officer has a Miranda right. They have a right to an attorney. They don't have to say anything to us. And we can't make them under that criminal law investigation. And what we've done is we've negotiated getting information from the officer. Rather than not having any statement from the officer under his right to remain silent or her right to remain silent, we negotiate with the unions and, okay, we need you to make a statement in the required time that you think that it's appropriate, where you've digested. If you have a good lawyer, sir, your lawyer is going to tell you not to talk to the police until they understand through discovery all the evidence against you. And so we're just trying to navigate as much as we can employment law versus criminal law and constitutional rights of every officer who's involved in a police-involved shooting to invoke their Miranda rights, not to make a statement at all. So we negotiated getting those statements in 3 days. But the officers don't have to make a statement to it at all, and we couldn't require them to. But because they're public servants, they do, and they have negotiated with us to give us a statement in 3 days. And that's complicated, but I hope I've explained that 72-hour rule really is negotiated with the unions and the officers to give us a statement when they absolutely have the Miranda right not to give us a statement at all.
What role do DPD investigators into the use of deadly force by officers play when those cases move to the grand jury?
In every case, our special investigative unit investigates all police-involved shootings. They prepare facts. They take statements. Take pictures through crime scene investigators, and they present that case file, all the statements, all the video, all the pictures that are available to the district attorney. The district attorney then has the opportunity to look at that case file and either add to that case file, maybe want to talk to more witnesses. They have an opportunity to do a little bit more than what our special investigative unit detectives have done. But ultimately, the district attorney presents that case to an independent grand jury in Dallas County. And that independent grand jury rules on whether or not that shooting was either justified or not justified. If it's justified, the officer is what's called no build. If the shooting is not justified, the grand jury rules that the officer is true build, which means they're indicted and has to stand trial.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to, looks like, Joshua in Dallas. Hi, Joshua, or Yashua?
It's Joshua. You're right, the latter. Good morning, Chris, and good morning to our chief.
Good morning,
Dr. Brown. In light of what you have actually experienced in terms of growing up and what you referred to for some unknown reason as challenged community, which is nothing more than the governmentally created and maintained African, predominantly African neighborhoods, how is it that you could come up with any plan, since the police are traditionally, historically, the enemy of African men and have been? They come from slave patrol. That's the origin of police. When police have the right, Chief Brown, to be able to write a ticket for African men based on somebody claiming that they assaulted them and the person is then ensnared into the injustice system, they are our enemies. How is it that you can come up with anything that's going to cause community policing? Police don't live in our neighborhoods. They're not required to live there. So I'd like to know what kind of magic wand, what kind of potion could there ever be to where community policing could actually generate the kind of so-called man-to-man, woman-to-woman trust of police, even African police?
Well, let me jump in, Joshua. It's a great question. I'm sure it's one that Chief Brown has heard before, and
yes,
I'm sure he would like a magic wand.
Sure. And there's no easy button either. There's no magic wand or easy button. I can tell you how we do it. With your help, sir. We have to do it with your help. Advocates in the community helping the police department. If you think about the police officer is supposed to be representative of the community. We're part of the community. But we have to engage people like yourself in resolving challenges and problems that the community perceives or that's factual. You know, so we need your help. We can't do it without you. You know, I always try to ease the conversation because it's a tense conversation to have to say, you know, if I've got to sing the Temptations, I need you. I don't care what I have to do, but I have to convince people in the neighborhood that we cannot, as a law enforcement agency, be successful without you. We need you absolutely, and without you, we can't make it. It's the truth. It's the reality of it. We need citizens like yourself to help us with this.
How much do you think that racial divisions in this community are related to or exacerbated by social class and economic status?
As much as we allow it to be. I think it can dominate the conversation, and you can never get to a solution because of the, like I mentioned, earned history, the earned bias that we have, some of the things that police officers have done that weren't right. But we've got to get past that conversation in order to have a better outcome than we have. We can't be held captive to history. We just can't and be in a better place. We have to face all of these challenges, and we have to push forward to for our kids, for ourselves, and really for society as a whole. It's a great democracy, but it requires our participation.
Does moving past that sense of, you know, justifiable outrage, does that require like one more sacrifice from the Black community?
I hope not. I hope that and venting is good. I've sat through a lot of vent sessions at churches and rec centers where people just scream and yell at me for an hour. And I'm required to sit there and take it because I work for them. But I try to wait to a calm moment in the session of venting to say, how can you help me?
What happens then?
Usually I get someone in the audience volunteering to do something. I said, I need your help with programming with your kids. We need to get your kids off the street and in positive relationships and positive interaction with the police. I need you to attend those programs for your kids. And once you do something for somebody's child, I don't care what the historical perspective is, you have an open door to great dialogue and greater outcomes in those communities. And so I really try to take advantage of venting sessions with communities to wait it out and see that, you know, what are some of the solutions that the community can help me with.
David Brown is chief of the Dallas Police Force. Chief Brown, thank you so much for making this time for us today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
By the way, the Facing Race National Conference takes place tomorrow through Saturday in Dallas. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.